You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Adam toku ingoa. Hello, welcome to The Wire for Wednesday the 5th of April. I'm your host today, Adam Jacobson. Unfortunately, Shamina has come down with a sickness and won't be joining us. But coming up on the show, we talk to a criminology expert about the government's plans to increase police numbers by 800 over the next 4 years. We discussed what exactly the Zeitgeist Movement is and talk to them about their upcoming Z-Day events. AUT Alan Blackman is joining us again for Dear Science today. We'll be talking about how margarine may not be so good after all, how a carbon-based sieve, which turns seawater into drinking water, has come about, and how volunteers for France's Space Medical Institute are getting paid to lay about. We speak to author Penelope Jackson to learn more about recent art crimes which took place in Parnell. And finally, we'll catch up with Tracy Williams to talk about how pop-up art installations are happening all around Auckland. If you want to let us know your thoughts on any issues we cover today, please give us a call on 309 3879 or text in on 5395.
So around, you know, up to 8,000 or 10,000.
Shit. The Wire.
But first, the government is planning on increasing police numbers by 800 over the next 4 years. In a recent Q&A interview, Minister for Police Paula Bennett stated the justification for this increase was to reduce crime across the board, saying the move should bring it down. I spoke with Agent Research Associate at Victoria University's Institute of Criminology, Kim Workman, about her comments on this increase, first questioning if an increase in police numbers is a viable way in actually reducing crime rates.
No, they don't. What they do promote is a feeling within the community that they are safe. So the more police they see around, the safer they feel. But over the last 30 years, all the research that has been done on this issue shows that the increase in police numbers don't result in a reduction of crime, and nor does it prevent crime. What generally happens is that the more police you have, the more enforcement you have, and the more arrests, which of course then leads into an increase in the crime rate.
So there doesn't seem to be a need for a boost to police numbers, in your opinion, then?
Yes, I think there is a case for perhaps reallocating the police resource, and clearly there is some dire need for extra policing in more in the provincial areas, I think, in places like Kaikohe and some of those, you know, the Thames and some of those provincial areas, which have really been starved of not only police resources but social services over many years. And unfortunately, what the government seems to think will happen is that if they increase the police numbers, you know, in the cities and nationwide, that will take care of the underlying social problems. So we see Minister Bennett talking about the police becoming truancy officers as well, which is an expansion, you know, of its traditional role, and is likely actually to, you know, not to address the real issues at all.
So rather than an increase of police numbers, what do you suggest should be done to actually reduce crime?
I think what we need to actually look at is what is the police role. And we're starting to lose a sense of what the police role is. The police are there to control crime and you know, to detect crime. The prevention of crime at the top of the cliff rather than the bottom is really the province of the community and community resources such as social workers and community-based social agencies. And I think what's happened in the last 30 years, we've seen a lack of resource put into social work practice, for example, with children and young people, and that's openly acknowledged by the government. But then it's gone ahead and increased police numbers, which means that inevitably the police turn up and take control of situations such as domestic violence and child abuse when they're not the appropriate agency to do that. And so it leads to a distrust of the police, really. Police, families who have had the police in a family violence situation are often less likely to report those situations to the police in the future. So we need to get that into balance.
How do you suggest that they go about getting it into balance?
Well, I think, you know, we need to look at the role of the police across the country and then look at the social climate within our nation and start to address and put resources into the contributors to crime rather than trying to control crime when it happens. So if you started to invest that resource into things like social housing, education, transition of young people from school to employment, community-based drug and alcohol treatment programs, and funding communities as much as social service organizations to respond to the situations that they have in their local community, you know, resourcing iwi, resourcing community-based organizations. The police are not the center of civil society and they're not the arbiter of social control. It's much wider than that. So we need to limit the role of the police and make sure that they are properly resourced where they can make the most impact.
Seeming as this is an election year, it does come rather timely that Minister Bennett would come out saying an increase in police numbers is needed. Does this appear to you more so as a political move rather than a substantial plan to reduce crime?
Yes, absolutely, and that's been the case for the last at least 30 years. And whenever an election comes, you know, all the parties, it doesn't matter which party it is, I mean, in Labor have come out saying we want more police, and New Zealand First, I think, want 2,000 police rather than 800, because they know that goes down well with the public. And anyone that argues against that is seen as anti-police, which is really unfortunate, especially when the minister says that her role is being a support for the police. Well, that's not a ministerial role at all. The minister's role is to make sure that their department is operating efficiently and effectively. It's not to support them, you know, against criticism.
Like, naked is the theme. Like, people just love getting naked.
That was Kim Workman, Research Associate at Victoria University's Institute of Criminology, talking about a proposal to increase police numbers by 800 over 4 years. Next up, a movement is arising which plans to abolish current political and economic systems, the Zeitgeist Movement, which aims to remove the need for a monetary economy and establish an economy model based upon the communal sharing of global resources. I spoke in studio with coordinators of the New Zealand Zeitgeist Movement, Sam Mentick and Wiri Timoni, about how the group plans on achieving this. We also touched upon upcoming events called Z-Day. I first asked what exactly the Zeitgeist Movement is.
The Zeitgeist Movement and advocates resource-based economics. And resource-based economics is basically a socio-economic system which looks to utilise technology and resources to its most efficient and best possible to accommodate all people and be as sustainable as possible for the environment.
Yes, so it utilises the scientific method for social concern, and basically all the resources of the world are the common heritage of all the world's people.
Right. So why exactly that? Why not just stick with what we've currently got?
There are a lot of reasons. The main reason is that money. Money is more of a hindrance to productiveness and the way we move forward. There's things like planned obsolescence, where people make things sub-quality-wise and they break down and you go through a lot of waste. There's also technological unemployment that's ramping up right now, which is automation taking over people's jobs. And so all of this is going to come to a crux if we don't look at another alternative.
That's right. And just to add to that, particularly with technological unemployment, one of the things that we won't be able to avoid in the next 15 to 20 years is we're going to reach 80% unemployment, including all the new jobs created. So we're going to be heading to a point where there really won't be a lot of work left for people to do. However, with technology and automation, we're actually going to be far more productive and efficient than we are today.
So essentially, the Zeitgeist movement is to uplift current social and economic barriers, essentially, such as capitalism and all of that, and monetary systems. How is it going to go about replacing this? Because that's such a massive undertaking to shift a whole globe's economic system.
That's right. Yeah, well, basically, we're looking for a platform that can support what's going to be coming up in the near future, basically the next 15 to 20 years. However, I do think it might even be sooner than that, more like 10 years, really. How are we going to do it? The transition, so to speak? Not sure. That's what we're looking to talk about on Sunday.
Yeah, transition is a big one, and there's going to be a lot of heartache through the transition. People might not want to change from what they're currently doing, but in the long run, it'll benefit them, and not only them, the children of the future. So at the moment, you're looking at things like UBI, Universal Basic Incomes. These are like incremental steps towards a resource-based economic model.
So essentially, the transition period will sort of come about due to technological advance. Are we at that point yet where it's a feasible thing to start initiating, or is this kind of off in the future sort of perspective?
Yeah, good question. I suppose a couple of things to think about, and for the listeners out there as well, is did anyone come to work today on their horse? The likely answer is no. Maybe a couple of people did.
I know, we've got some pretty weird listeners on the FM.
I mean, if you did text in, let us know. Yeah. but it's unlikely that anyone came to work on a horse, nor is anyone using a Nokia 3210. We're using smartphones and we're driving cars. Why is that? Because technology has made something better than what was happening before that. That's going to happen on a global scale and is happening now. That's actually why we've seen, you know, guys like the T-Man get into power in America. Brexit happen as well. You know, these are all shifts that are happening through technological unemployment and sort of major socioeconomic shifts. So we're seeing change. It is inevitable. And, you know, what are we going to do to support this new change coming in?
The other thing I want to add to that is biosocial pressures, things like pollution, what's happening in the environment will actually drive us to look at a new change as well. If you go to places like Southeast Asia, there's pollution everywhere. They're using sub-quality oils and it's polluting the whole atmosphere. So these are things that not only those with a lot of money, like the wealthy, will have to make changes, but everyone will have to look at making changes. So we're all vulnerable to these biosocial pressures.
Right. What I'm hearing is it sounds almost communistic in its approach to like an economic model. How does it differ from this?
Communism had money. A resource-based economic system does not utilize money at all. It utilizes you having access abundance, access to resources, access to the basic necessities of life. Also, in terms of government, communism's got governments in a resource-based economic system. The form of government would be more like a collaborative mechanism, like a cybernetic computer we can all interact with. So it's totally different from your so-called communist outlook. Also, there are no armies in a resource-based economic model.
Yeah, just to add to that, so capitalism, socialism, communism, they all had an overarching mechanism, which is the monetary system. So yep. Resource-based economics won't have that. And you could say, you know, you could argue that that's one of the reasons that those three systems failed.
Right.
Or because of this monetary system. And in terms of resource access, at the moment, and I don't know if a lot of people know this out there, but with food, we produce 50% of the food we produce every year goes to waste. That's throughout the whole world. So anytime you have a meal, just remember there's one that's already gone in the rubbish bin.
Mm.
It's the same with clothes. And the only thing that's really lacking a bit at the moment is housing and building production. That's probably a little bit slower at the moment. But we can right now in China, we're actually printing 4-story apartment blocks in under a week.
Oh, wow.
So in terms of access to resource, we already have it. We already have enough out there. The only thing that's actually stopping people accessing it is money. It's artificial scarcity that's being created.
Right. So will the abolishment of a monetary system be a like enacted thing, or will it just be a part of the progress moving towards that resource-based economy?
It is a really good question, and that's again why we're having the meetup on Sunday at the Greyland Community Hall at 2 p.m.
Right.
It's really to talk about that. That this transition is the big question. We don't really have the answers to that yet, but we want to ask those questions and we want to start making it happen. And also, New Zealand is a perfect place to test something like this out, perhaps by taking one city, a city that might not be doing so well, like, for example, Kaitaia,
yep,
which is almost left to its own resources at the moment. I don't know if anyone's been up there recently, but I was pretty surprised the last time I went up there. So, you know, we could take a city like Kaitaia in New Zealand and test an RBE out and see how it works. We need testing. We need to find out, if it is going to work. And the testing that has gone on with, particularly with the UBI, Universal Basic Income, is we've seen great results so far. When everyone's getting a basic wage, productivity goes up, health goes up, crimes goes down, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, UBI is one of the good incremental steps to gauge how we could look at implementing an RBE. And as Sam said, the implementation in various countries through trials have shown that increases of productivity, health, and all these sorts of things when people have basic necessities of life. And that's all we need is the basic necessities of life, food, shelter, all those sorts of things, which will free us from the survival mode that we're all in. Example, 9-to-5 job, trying to make money so we can get those basic necessities of life. But if you look at Maslow's pyramid of hierarchical needs, you'll see it's 5 levels. The 2 bottom levels are survival mode.
Yeah.
The top 3 levels are self-actualization. So an RBE gets rid of those 2 bottom levels of survival mode so we can focus on things like recreation, time with the family, creating and expressing our uniqueness and creativity.
So you're saying all of this is going to be discussed on April the 9th. Would you be able to explain exactly what this day is, what's kind of happening, and if people want to go and visit or
sure.
join along?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so it's the Greyland Community Hall at 2 p.m. this Sunday.
It's called Z-Day.
It's called Z-Day, yeah. That's correct. It's the 9th annual educational symposium towards global unity and abundance.
Okay.
So, yeah, it's a nice big long sentence there. So, and this is part of an international event that happens around the world. We've actually just come back from Brisbane, where it happened there as well, an absolutely amazing festival. That happened over 2 days. Our one will just be between 2 and 6 p.m. And we've got a number of really fantastic speakers, some of which are coming over from America and Australia as well.
Cool. Would you be able to just say who a few of these speakers might be?
Yes, we've got Michael Kubler. He's from TZM chapter in Australia. He's going to be talking about transition towards the RBE economy. We've also got John Belmont, an RBE advocate, and he's going to be talking about a few barter economy issues. We've got Amanda Garland. She's from the Earthsong Eco Neighbourhood. Richard Osmiston from the Money Free Party, Jeff Simmons from the Opportunities Party, and we've got Marina Bloom from Moving Stuff.
Is there anything you'd like to add on top of that?
Well, be there at 2 p.m. at the Greyland Community Hall. And if you disagree with anything we're talking about today, we want to see you there as well, because we want to have a good, healthy discussion and debate about this stuff. It's really important.
Bring your questions down and come and discuss it with us. And, we're there to help one another so you guys can understand what RBE is about. So it'd be great to see you. Thank you.
Perfect. Thanks, guys.
Pre-wire. Their relationships with their girlfriends or their wife. No one, they shouldn't have more than one wife at a time.
That was coordinators of the New Zealand Zeitgeist Movement, Sam Mentick and Wiri Timone, discussing the Zeitgeist Movement and their upcoming Z-Day events. Coming after the break, we'll be back with Dear Science.
The stone-hard riffing machine that is Endless Boogie returned to New Zealand for one psyched-out Auckland show April 23rd at the Tuning Fork, and we're giving you tickets.
Kiss did not bring their own kites. They were kites.
Playing psychedelic rock and roll that stretches every last second out to the edge of forever. Electric boogie locking groove so tight there's no escape. 95BFM's Dirtbag Radio presents Endless Boogie April 23rd at the Tuning Fork. Listen to BFM for your chance to win tickets.
Real Groovy Records brings you the 95BFM Jazz Show. Sunday afternoons from 12 till 2.
Something new and something exciting. Something new and something exciting will happen. Something very new.
The Jazz Show. a show for the jazz-wise and the otherwise, with your hosts, Blind Mango Chutney, Duncan Campbell, and myself, Def Jim, bringing you 2 hours of the music that jazz became and the music it's becoming. The Jazz Show, Sundays from midday, proudly brought to you by Real Groovy Records, 369 Queen Street.
Science is interesting, and if you don't agree, you can fuck off.
And we're joined here again with Alan Blackman. How's it going, Alan?
G'day,
for Dear
Adam.
Science?
Yep, very well, thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah, it's good to see you. So, it turns out butter isn't the bad guy after all, and margarine's actually the terrible one.
Well, this is kind of interesting. I guess anybody who's read the Herald in the past couple of days will have seen a story sort of extolling the virtues of butter and saying that margarine has been found to be bad for you. And it's all to do with these saturated fats and unsaturated fats and trans fats and all that sort of stuff. And it all sort of hails from about the 1950s, apparently, when the first link or supposed link between saturated fats and poor health, poor cardiac health, was made in a study. And then because of that, people all around the world, all the doctors, all the nutritionists and everything said cut back on all of these sorts of things, all your dairy products, all your milks and your butters and your you know, your meats, etc., etc., because they're bad for you because they contain lots of saturated fats. So what the author of that study didn't say was that they were studying about 22 countries around the world. They took the data from 6 countries that agreed with their sort of hypothesis.
Oh, right. Very, very selective data mining.
Yeah. And so they just got rid of all the data that didn't agree with their results, apparently, the other 16 countries. Apparently, when you include all of the data, then the effect disappears. So apparently, saturated fats are not that bad for you. So people have been laying off the butter and stuff like that.
Yeah, because I remember growing up always being told that butter was the devil, effectively. You know, you've got to stay away from that nasty milk solid.
Yes, yeah, well, seemingly not. Well, what these guys have done, these guys in Canada, they've undertaken a study, and they didn't do any of the actual work themselves. What they did was they looked at all of the other studies that have been done since the year dot on the relationship between saturated fats and heart health, and on these trans fats and heart health. So they got all of that. They then reanalyzed all of the data. So we're talking sort of a cohort of a few hundred thousand people over the years. And they basically found that there wasn't really any correlation between poor health, diabetes, heart disease, all that sort of stuff, and saturated fats. But they did find a 34% increase in death rates from trans fats, apparently.
Oh.
So trans
That's
fats,
a nice thing to
yeah,
know.
Indeed.
Yeah.
And trans fats comes from palm oil. They come from palm oil, and they're primarily used to make margarine and sort of snack foods and stuff like that. So there does appear to be some sort of correlation there. And so seemingly now the warning is don't sort of go too heavy on the margarine because of these trans fats, and they do seem to be not very good for you.
Right.
Now, the interesting thing about all this, and as I said, if you've been this was in the Herald, I think, either yesterday or the day before, and it's sort of being presented as a big news story, but on having a look at the original paper on which this is based, it was actually published in 2015.
Oh,
so this is
okay.
2 years ago. So this is actually old news, so
yeah.
I don't quite know why this has been recycled at this particular time. Maybe a slow news day or something like
maybe,
that?
Not
sure.
So what exactly is the difference between a trans fat and a saturated fat?
I knew you were going to ask that. Okay, who knows any chemistry, folks?
Nope.
Okay, we have these little things called double bonds in molecules. What's the best way to describe this? Saturated fats don't have any double bonds, basically. So think of to make a saturated fat into an unsaturated fat, you treat it with hydrogen.
Okay.
Basically. Okay. Saturated fats have got particular, unsaturated fats have got particular shapes, which means they don't necessarily pack well together.
Okay? Right.
And you've got these two possible things. You've got trans fats and you've got cis fats. And trans fats tend to be solids because they can pack together well, and the cis ones tend to be liquids because they can't. So things like olive oil that have got these cis linkages in them, which is the opposite of trans,
yep, yep.
They're good for you.
Right.
Okay. The trans ones, because they can all sort of pack together and they're solids at room temperature rather than being liquids, they're the bad ones.
So they effectively just stick inside of you almost.
Yeah, basically, yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. So your cis and your trans fats have got double bonds and your saturated fats don't. So they treat all the double bonds with hydrogen. They actually do that on an industrial scale and that turns your unsaturated fats into saturated fats. And as I say, you know, the thinking was that these saturated fats weren't great for you, but now, woof, go
so
crazy.
We'll switch around. So up next, it looks like that new developments in saltwater filtration have come about using a type of carbon. Am I right? And it's carbon?
It is not a type of carbon. It is carbon.
It is carbon,
It is
right.
carbon. Okay.
Yeah. Would you better explain more of this?
I can certainly try. So one of the big problems facing the world in the future is access to clean drinking water. And particularly in the more arid regions of the planet where they don't get any rainfall, they have to somehow treat seawater in order to make it potable. Otherwise, they just ain't going to be able to survive there. And so in certainly the Middle East and certainly in Australia as well, there are desalination plants that have been set up, and they provide an enormous percentage of the drinking water, the daily drinking water, certainly in the Middle East anyway. And to a lesser extent in Australia. And so these work basically by passing seawater under pressure through a thing called a semi-permeable membrane.
Okay? Like a cell, effectively.
Like a cell, like a big sheet, basically,
okay.
if you want to think of it something like that, okay?
Yeah.
And this membrane, you pressurize the water through it, basically, and what happens is the water goes through, but the salt stays on the other side.
Okay.
Okay. Now, the way that these work, you do get a lot of salt residues and stuff that you've then got to get rid of. You've got, you know, enormous amounts of salt that we're talking
about.
So you've then got to get rid of that, and so they've got to go and dump it out in the ocean. And then there's people thinking, well, shit, you can't really do that because that's going to interfere with the sea life, et cetera, putting these enormous amounts of salt into the ocean. So people are looking for a new way, I guess, of actually doing this. And so these guys have come up with a way of using a thing called graphene oxide. And graphene sounds a little bit like graphite, which is the stuff that you get in your pencil.
Yeah.
Okay. And the way you make graphene from graphite is you get a piece of sticky tape and you put it on your graphite and you just peel it off.
Really?
And that gives you a single layer of graphite, essentially, because graphite is a layered compound. It's just carbon atoms and in layers. And somebody won the Nobel Prize for that, for doing just that, for taking a piece of sticky tape, putting it on graphite and peeling these layers of graphene off. And graphene's got really unusual properties. It's a really remarkable material. Graphene oxide, you make that by just taking graphene and leaving it out in the air, and it oxidizes, et cetera, et cetera. But what these guys have found is that if you take sheets now of graphene oxide and put them really close together and basically sort of hold them apart using epoxy resin, sort of glue, and you can hold them apart at a particular distance, which is very, very small. We're talking nanometers here. And what they found is that if you pass salt water through that now, the water goes through because it's really kind of slippery inside, so the water really likes it, goes through really fast. But all your salt ions, your sodium ions, your chloride ions, all of that sort of stuff, they're too big, and they can't actually get through the gap. So this thing, by the look of it, you don't have to exert the same sort of pressures that they do in sort of current desalination techniques.
Right.
Of course, they've only done this on a very, very small scale. It's a preliminary thing. It was published this week, I think, in Nature Nanotechnology, the journal. And so obviously, as they say in this, that there's a lot more work needing to be done. We've got to scale it up, et cetera, et cetera. But it's proof of principle, and it's kind of cool, you know. So it could – and, you know, graphene is a relatively cheapish material.
I've heard it's kind of a wonder material, as in you could create space elevators and things like this out of it. It's a superconductor.
They said that about things called buckyballs, which I don't know if you've heard of, Buckminster fullerene. That was another form of carbon that they discovered in about the late 1980s, early 1990s, and that was going to – it looks like a soccer ball.
Okay.
So it's these carbon with arranged like a soccer ball with alternating hexagons and pentagons. And that was going to save the world as well. And again, the guys who made that got the Nobel Prize as well. So it hasn't quite panned out as such.
Yeah, we're not seeing space elevators being built anytime soon.
We're not seeing space elevators. And I remember they were talking about them probably about 20-odd years ago.
Right.
They just put them up there and they just pull them up on these big, long sheets of carbon, but nah, hasn't happened
yet. Nah. Okay. So, I hear that the best job in the world is currently going, where you can effectively lie down on the job.
Absolutely. Yep. Who's up for being paid 16,000 euros for 2 months' work?
Yep. I've got to raise my hand for that.
Okay, and all you have to do is stay in bed for 2 months
with
at least one shoulder on the bed.
That's with at least one shoulder on the bed.
One shoulder on the bed. That's the proviso.
Is it like a big comfy bed? Or?
Well, I think it'll be pretty uncomfortable after 2 months. Probably.
I'd imagine. Yeah. I'd imagine.
So, for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, the French science aerospace science network are looking at the effects of microgravity or prolonged microgravity on the human being, basically. So, the way that they're going to do this is basically get some folk to lie in a bed for 2 months, doing absolutely everything, eating, drinking, and all the rest, in a bed. You've got to keep your head inclined at a particular angle or something, apparently. And so they're looking for 25, male volunteers, and you've got to be aged between, 22 and 45. You've got to have a BMI of between 22 and 27. No smokers need apply. And then once they sort you out and make sure you're all fit and healthy and everything like that, they undergo a battery of tests for a couple of weeks. Then you're in the bed for two solid months, 60 days. And then at the end of that, it's another 2 weeks tests and to see how you've coped with the apparent effects of microgravity. Apparently staying in bed for 2 months is the same sort of thing as experiencing.
Yeah, that's what I was about to question. You know, I would have thought there'd be a vast difference between kind of floating and lying in bed.
I would have thought so too, but you know, these guys know what they're doing, I'm sure.
Effectively. So what exactly do the effects of microgravity tend to have on people? What are they trying to find out?
Well, they're trying to see if they can alleviate sort of things like people get lower bone density, muscle wasting, all of that sort of stuff happens when these guys go up in space. So just because you're not using, you know, your muscles and bones, etc., like you normally would in gravity. So the whole point of this apparently is trying to see if they can somehow sort out how to get over these sorts of problems, which are going to be problems for any sort of prolonged space mission or whatever. Apparently at the end of sort of a decent amount of time, people can't walk, you know, they've got to sort of learn to walk again after they've been in space for a while. And so it's all of that stuff. 16,000 euro for 2 months in bed.
I don't know. It sounded promising to start with, but the whole one shoulder always lying down doesn't sound very comfortable after a while.
Bed sores.
Not good. Well, thank you again, Alan.
We'll see you
again next week.
Okay, shall do. See
Cheers.
Ya.
That was Dear Science.
So, now up. An art heist that saw two prominent Lindor paintings stolen over the weekend has sparked a conversation about art crime in New Zealand. BFM reporter Joe Guy spoke to the author of Art Thieves, Fakers and Fraudsters, Penelope Jackson, earlier this morning to learn more.
What do you make of the two famous Lindau paintings that were stolen from the International Art Centre in Parnell over the weekend?
It's a terrible situation. Tragic, really, that these two works that people are sort of labelling as national treasures or, you know, New Zealand icons have gone missing. And the very real fear, of course, is that we don't know where they are and we don't know what kind of condition they're in. And, you know, as a lot of people have said, and there's been a lot of speculation over the last few days, the way that they were taken and the speed that they were taken at, you know, I'm sure they will have sustained some kind of damage. And of course they're 113 years old, so they're very vulnerable, they're precious works. And those of us who work in the, you know, fine arts sector take great care when moving work, you know, white gloves, sponges, they're wrapped correctly, etc. And unfortunately, you know, those precautions, I'm sure, of course, we know from the CCTV footage, were not, you know, taken. So it's really sad. There is a lot of speculation around, you know, what has happened to them, why it's happened, the motivation. But until the culprits are caught or charged, we don't know. And, but, you know, let's just hope that they return safely.
This isn't the first time that Lindau's work has been targeted, right? Because in 2012 and I think 2014 too, other portraits were both in public collections were also found to be fraudulent. So are there any other New Zealand artists that have been more consistent targets than others?
Look, you know, Goldie, certainly there's a catalogue of art crimes around Charles Goldie from works being vandalised, stolen, and then, of course, New Zealand's, I suppose, best-known forger, Carl Sim, who actually changed his name so he could sign it, you know, as Goldie. He was the first New Zealander in 1985 to be convicted and charged with fraud, and that was art fraud. So, yeah, so poor old Goldie, he's kind of, as I say in my book, a bit of a textbook case because his works have been stolen, forged, vandalised, you name it. But Lindauer, as you say, he's taken a bit of a hammering as well because there have been forgeries that have popped up, and the most recent one being the Alexander Turnbull Library in 2015 or 14, maybe the year before. They purchased a work that they were actually advised that perhaps it wasn't an authentic Lindauer, but they went ahead and purchased it and, of course, subsequently found out that it wasn't and had to come clean about it. Well, I didn't say it had to come clean, but they did. They were very open about the find. So, yeah, poor, you know, Lindauer's taken a bit of a hammering lately as well.
Mm. And, yeah, as you mentioned in your book, Art Thieves, Fakers and Fraudsters, it's kind of the first comprehensive work about art crime in New Zealand. It's kind of emphasised that the link between art history and crime is often attributed as being a foreign thing. So do we have a long history of art crime in New Zealand?
Yeah, we do. Look, I mean, you know, the book obviously covers a lot of cases in New Zealand, but sadly there's enough for, you know, another book. There are a lot more cases. And, you know, that's kind of always the question, oh, does it really happen down here in New Zealand? Well, it does. And I think, you know, the amount of interest that's been created over the last few days over the Lindauers just shows, I guess, there's that kind of community outpouring of anger and grief, and people just thinking, you know, how could this happen? You know, confusion about it. But look, it does happen. Everywhere you've got an art history, you've got, you know, backstories, you've got a history of crime, unfortunately. And, you know, I was just thinking that in the last month, there have been four art crime stories in New Zealand that have made it into the media. So there could well have been other ones that didn't make it. So these are ones we know about. So in early March, there was an article in the New Zealand Herald about a large collection of works by Carl Sim, I just mentioned him, the forger, that had been put up on Trade Me, and fortunately no one was interested in buying them, so that was good. The second one was on the 19th of March. There was a story about the Otago Art Society and how they'd been caught up with the Francis Hodgkins exhibition, and there was a question about how authentic those works were authentic or not. So that was another story. And then later on in March, there was a story that actually came to us from the UK, from England, but it was about two New Zealand artists, McCann and Gordon Walters, and it was about how their works had sold very, very cheaply at an auction, you know, deal of the century, but were they real, you know, McCanns and Walters or not? And then, of course, this last weekend we've had the Lindauers. So that's just four in the last, well, 4 weeks. So that gives you an idea that, yes, we do have art crime in New Zealand, and there's, you know, some of them are significant crimes.
Mm. It's kind of crazy that we don't really hear about these things. Do you think that's because most people kind of perceive the culture of art crime as being a very European thing, or is it just that we like to dissociate from the subject entirely?
I think it's probably both, really, that, you know, often we've thought it's, you know, as a European story, and often, you know, big cases, you know, Van Gogh found, etc., in Naples a few months ago and things like that. So you do get those big stories, international stories, and certainly, with, you know, they're still finding works that the Nazis, you know, took and have been repatriated now. So they always sort of make the headlines as well. I think the other thing about art crime is that sometimes the crimes go unreported, just for fear of copycat crime, of course, and also that sometimes it's embarrassing. You know, when the Alexander Turnbull Library came out and said, actually, we've bought this work and it's not what it was meant to be, we thought it was kind of thing. You know, people said, oh my goodness, you know, that was public money, and there was kind of this outcry, you know. Look, they did front up to it. There are, you know, I would say that there are fortunate works in a lot of collections, you know, around the world, and people don't know about them, you know, or they're, let's put it this way, they're not advertised. So you get that. Also, you know, domestic collectors, often they're not going to admit to purchasing perhaps a lemon. So for all kinds of reasons. And, you know, it is the kind of the dark side or the seedier side of art history. It's not the easiest subject matter to research and to write about.
Yeah. Did you come across any kind of notable heists when researching for your book?
Well, look, I do talk about some of the, you know, the bigger heists in my book and some of the smaller unknown stories and things. And for the most part, people were very generous in sharing their information. But, you know, there are some things that you just never kind of get to the bottom of. Like, you know, when the James Tissot painting Still on Top was stolen from Auckland Art Gallery in the late 90s, the insurers put up a reward for $50,000. And I tried really hard to find out whether that was ever actually paid out or not, because there were different stories in the paper, but you know, you have to, you can't always believe what you read in the paper. And I just kept on, you know, meeting brick walls. So, you know, that's what I'm saying about art crime. It's it can be quite complex to research.
Yeah.
I mean, and the other thing is, it is crime, and not all crimes are solved. Well, so not everything has a happy ending, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, in the do you think the nature in which these art crimes are conducted have kind of changed over the years?
Oh, look, I think, you know, it does change. And I think, you know, you mentioned the Lindau, the Fraudulent Works, and I mentioned Goldie. And it's, you know, look, both those artists are long dead. So, of course, there's a lack of those works in circulation. So it's a bit, you know, economics, you know, demand and supply kind of thing. So someone sees a niche there. I think in terms of a technology, on the one hand, it's probably easier to... you know, if you think of digital photography now and getting images of works if you wanted to make a forgery. And, you know, look, there was an interesting exercise that I carried out at Waikato Museum late last year. We put on an exhibition about art crimes in New Zealand, and part of it was to educate people. And so we selected two works from the collection there, took just JPEGs of them, sent them off to Defen in China, where there's, you know, like 8,000 artists work. They copy art. And we had, within 3 weeks, we had copies made of these works and sent back to New Zealand and put them on exhibition next to the originals. And people, visitors to the museum, had to guess which was the real one and which wasn't, which was a really, you know, interesting kind of engagement. What it demonstrated was that the speed at which these could be carried out, but also how good the copies were, and all they had were those JPEGs. They never actually saw the works in the flesh. So these are artists on the other side of the world. They open up their email, they see this, you know, image that I've sent, and they've made a copy. So in terms of technology, you know, of course, things are changing. Having said that, the flip side of that is, at the weekend, those Lindau's, images of them, were out on the internet all around the world within minutes.
CCTV and cameras kind of tracked everything, didn't they?
Absolutely. And just the images of those works, because they had really good digital images of them from the auction house. You know, there was a story in The Guardian, Interpol knew, it was all around the world. So anyone way down the track, say if these works don't surface, and way down the track someone is offered them for sale, they only have to do a quick Google search and bingo, they're going to pop up. So that's, you know, really good. And I tell the other story in my book too, about a sculpture that was stolen. And a decade later, someone was looking at a house for sale on the internet, and they recognised the sculpture in one of the, you know how you can go onto real estate websites and you go through all the rooms and look at them, and this person saw the sculpture and thought, I recognise that. That used to be outside the Epsom Library. And sure enough, it was. You know, quick little call to the police, and they went round and collected it. So that's kind of the flip side. So there's the positive and the negative in terms of your question about technology and change with art crimes over time.
Yeah. And lastly, where does art crime sit in New Zealand in comparison to the rest of the world?
Look, that's a really, it's a really hard thing to kind of measure or gauge. And often, because of the media, it's sometimes art crimes are sensationalised, so they might appear appear bigger, proportionally bigger than they are. But there's often a statistic that's kind of bandied about, well, not a statistic, but a, I suppose a quote internationally, that art crime is third next to arms and drugs.
Oh, wow.
And so it's kind of up there, you know, but we're talking, I guess, if you think internationally, some of the things that, you know, go missing or, you know, or found, like the Van Goghs recently. But I think the bottom line is that it is a very real problem, and sometimes it's kind of, you know, some people have the attitude that art is a luxury item, it's elitist. So, of course, you know, why should police resources be put into that as opposed to something else, you know?
Mm.
So it's a really, really, it's difficult, but certainly it is a problem. We do have a history and a catalogue of art crimes in New Zealand, and clearly, given the events of last weekend, it is ongoing.
Trust BFM? Sure can.
That was author of Art, Thieves, Fakers and Fraudsters, Penelope Jackson, speaking about recent New Zealand art crimes. After the break, we will be talking to Auckland Council members about pop-up art.
Paint It Gold and Niche present Bonobo, live in Auckland. Ninja Tune artist Simon Green, aka Bonobo, has been touring the world with the music from his masterful, magisterial sixth album, Migration. Now, his place firmly cemented in the very highest echelons of electronic music and indeed beyond, Bonobo touches down with his full live band at the Auckland Town Hall, Thursday, July 27, with very special guest Romare. Be listening to 95BFM for your chance to win tickets.
Oh, it's 2 o'clock. Back on the Good Foot's about to start.
No, wait! What are you doing? I'm not wearing any shoes.
Huh?
Oh no! It's too late! The salacious mix of quality grooves! It's too much! I can't not dance! It's only a matter of time before my poor unprotected feet are ground down to wet chalky nubs and I'm left totally footless!
I mean, I can just turn off the radio.
No, I like this song.
Back on the Good Foot, dousing you in solid soul toe tappers, rock steady groovers, and filthy funk freakouts every Sunday from 2 till 4 with your delightful hosts, Tina Turntables and Mr. Crawley. Back on the Good Foot, proudly presented by Auckland's Shoemaster Generals, Pat Menzies. They've got your dancing shoes sorted and anything else your good feet could wish for. Walk on down to the Canterbury Arcade at 174 Queen Street, get on up to their new store in St. Kevin's Arcade on K Road, or pop online to patmenziesshoes.co.nz.
Oh man, I just realised Good Foot and it's a shoe shop. That's classic. Good job, sales team.
It's fucked.
Yeah, it is.
The Wire.
The Auckland Council and Waitemata Local Board are back to bring you POP, an annual series of art installations happening around Auckland City. BFM reporter Joe Guy spoke to the head of creative strategy at Auckland Council, Tracy Williams, to learn more, starting off by asking what POP is and how it came about.
POP is essentially a series of temporary public art activations that happen across the city. They have placemaking outcomes. POP came about because we, as a unit of Auckland Council, the Arts and Culture Unit, very much put our hands on our hearts in thinking about the Chapter 3 of the Auckland Plan, which talks about integrating arts and culture into everyday life. And so I guess it was very much came about as a response to that. It was prompted by trying to solve that problem, which is the question was, what does that look like? What is that? And if you look at a lot of what's happening in Auckland and thinking about what, for example, what council's role is, which is not, we're not an arts organisation, we're an infrastructure organisation, and that talks to us about being here to help create a city and people's experience of a city, and being sort of that a layer of how people experience their city. So POP was about using arts and culture and using creativity to, I guess, shift people's perceptions of their city and the way they relate to each other. So, and if you look at that whole landscape and the whole of the inner city and then the rest of Auckland, go, what is everybody else doing? We're not, we are a piece of the pie. If you kind of go, theatres are doing that and galleries are doing that, and looking at who's been served by what and kind of going, where are the gaps? And for us, us, the gaps were very much, the gap was very much around art, where the, putting art where the people are, really. That's how you can define it. So we kind of flipped that traditional model of how people experience art on its head, turned it upside down and went, actually, let's just start with the place and the people. We don't need to sort of do more of what everyone else is doing. And so it was actually as simple as that, as literally putting art where people are as a means of integrating arts and culture into everyday life. The other bit of pop is that it's highly participatory. Like, the artwork is not the thing. The art is what happens when people engage with the project. So, for example, like, the art doesn't happen with pop ping pong, for example, unless people pick up a bat and play ping pong.
Right.
You know, it's not the tables that are the art. It's actually the act of getting involved and then this kind of creative activation in this particular spot of the city.
So is it the kind of interactive aspect of this particular project that sets it apart from maybe
it
other
does.
Installations?
It really does. It's like, what sets it apart is that it's, well, I think there are several things, but I think one of the key things is that it's audience-centric.
Mm.
It's audience-centric programming approach. It's a very place-based programming approach. And the other thing that sets it apart is that it actually, the art is the act of taking part. That is where the work happens. So I guess, you know, there are plenty of examples all over the world for that type of practice. And, you know, if you put your pointy academic hat on, you might call it social practice. So I guess, you know, it has its roots and, you know, and a lot of types of creative practice that are going on, but actually it's unique in its manifestation of that.
Right. And did this also kind of prompt the decision then to expand it to the kind of outskirts of Auckland? Because I believe it was a central city project kind of up until this year.
It very much was, and that actually, the genesis of that is that it was started as a local board-funded program of work, and so that was the genesis of it being central city-based, but it was also a key opportunity to actually think through that problem, to go, well, what is the gap in the inner city? And I guess that's what really prompted it, because it's going, if you're going to do a community arts program, which is essentially what the budget was called, if you're going to do that in the inner city, what would that be? Because there are theatres, there are galleries, there's actually a lot going on. So there was sort of an intervention logic that applied, and then through that process, POP was developed. And POT was developed by working alongside a group of creatives working that sort of specialise in sort of human-centred design and community engagement alt group. They're based in the Waitemata local board area. So it was very much sort of working with council, working with the alt group, working with the Waitemata local board, and at the same time working with a bunch of artists to, you know, we didn't just do it, it wasn't a straight line to get to POP. It was a whole lot of people going, so what's the problem we're trying to solve? What does that look like? And POP was born out of that process. And it very much did start as a series of piloted projects, like tested, which was essentially just testing this idea. Year two was around, I guess, underscoring that idea and going, actually becoming really clear about what, you know, what POP stands for, what its characteristics are. POP's fun, POP's engaging, POP's about participation, and POP is in public space, all those types of things. And then each year we've developed from there. And it was really around the potential for POP to actually activate other sites in Auckland, obviously in a slightly different way, because the communities are different and the places are different. But some of the projects that we've tested, like POP Ping Pong last year, was so highly successful. We did actually test it last year just in a couple of areas, just because we weren't sure. You can have an idea about, you know, how great something's going to be, but unless you sort of take that step to test it, you don't know. And this year we've sort of gone, formalised that step with going, yes, we are now doing this thing in the other parts of Auckland.
That's very cool. I also kind of noticed that not only have you expanded geographically, but you've also kind of expanded in terms of diversity with Pop Poi and Pop Waiata.
Yeah.
So that's really cool to see. Who are some of the local artists that alt groups collaborating with this year?
The collaboration, I must say, has always been between the local board and Arts and Culture staff and Oak Grove and artists. I think that's another thing, to go back to your earlier question, what sets Pop apart, because it is in public space. There's a massive team of people that come together to realise these projects. We're also working with Fresh Concept this year to help with the sort of delivery part of it, because that's their specialisation. So it's really incredible what it does in terms of bringing people together, that, you know, in every way. Like, the projects do that, but actually the back end of the projects do that as well. Okay, so we're working with New Zealand Dance Company. Mm-hmm. On a project called Pop Knot. They're based in the Waitematā local board area, working with a couple of artists on Pop Skip Jump. They are Marika Newman and Sahara, if I've got your name wrong. And we're working with them. They work under the umbrella, the moniker Bored and Broke. And they just, actually their project is just going around with big long skipping robes, dressed up in pop costumes and skipping.
Yeah.
We're working with Geneva Masters, who's actually, she's a performer, she's a musician, she's a songwriter, she's also a product designer. She came up with this great idea but essentially, it's karaoke on buses, but with Waiata. So it's taking that sort of karaoke idea and extending it to Waiata, and we're running that on all Auckland transport routes. That is one that started in the inner city and will become regional. So that's Geneva Masters. We're also working with, and I feel really, really terrible about this, their name's Piri Wehongi, and his collaborator, who's another artist who are heavily involved with like Polyfest and Te Mata Tini, and those, you know, working at that level, Māori performance, have actually brought together another troupe of performers that they lead that are doing these pop-up poi performances. Mm. You may have seen some of them on Facebook. And they're both based locally. Oh, yeah, and then there's a group of actually an architecture interns working on a project called Pop Drop.
Oh, cool.
And so they're all based in the Waitematā local board area. So we're looking to work with people who are based sort of living and working or working in the Waitematā, to be true to, you know, the intent and the spirit of that budget, that it was very much around working with local artists. Pop Fiesta is a group of drummers, performance drummers, and they've very much, I guess their home base would be Toiora Arts Trust, which is based in the Waitematā area, and it's led by Monica Evans, and she works with all sorts of different local groups of youth and does these sort of big flash mob performances that involve a whole lot of percussion and really get people who are standing in the audience involved. So those are some examples of some of the artists we're working with. And then of course we've got some of the old favourites like Pop Marbles and Pop Ping Pong, that people, you know, sort of practically chain themselves to those projects when they get taken away each year because they're just so loved and adored. So it makes sense, because we, you know, those assets exist, to use them over multiple sites, over multiple years. Those are the same projects that will be taken to those outer areas.
And so
the difference with the Waitematā projects is that there are a whole lot of like smaller, and I don't mean smaller in any value sense, it's just that they don't involve the building of assets necessarily, they're a lighter touch. These projects that are very, very artist-led and very community-involved, like Pop Fiesta involving the drummers and Skip Jump and Pop Poi and Pop Waiata.
Yeah. So that's really cool that a lot of local artists are involved. And I think when I was reading about it this morning, it kind of mentioned, you know, like the street corners, trains and everything in between will kind of be bursting with these surprise artworks around Auckland.
Yeah.
So that's really cool. Where can people go to learn more about Pop?
So the best place to go to learn more about Pop is actually the Pop Facebook page.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just, I think it's Pop Community, it's called Pop Community on Facebook. If you just type Pop Community, you'll see the the pop font, which is very distinctive and unique, and just like that page, I think, is the best way to learn more. There's a lot of information there, and then there's also a website, which is pop.org.nz.
That was The Wire.
That was Tracy Williams discussing pop-up art installations happening across Auckland at the moment. That marks the end of another Wednesday show. Thank you for those who spoke with us today and the pieces that we played. Kim Workman, Penelope Jackson, Alan Blackman, Sam Mentick, Wiri Timoni, and Tracy Williams. Thanks heaps to Joe Guy and Caitlin for helping me out today as a last-minute thing. Also, thank you for tuning in. Shamina will be back next week. Stay tuned for the 1 to 4 with Bridge coming up next.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.